Namaste and in Lakech, and welcome to this episode of One World in a New World. I'm your host, Zen Benefiel, and this week's guest is Kevin Strauss. Kevin's a very unique character in the mental health field, and we'll get into that in a moment. He has a company called Uchi, which is a social app for facilitating private guided communication to strengthen relationships, nurture mental health and emotional well-being, and improve behaviors. We can always use that, right? He's the author of Innovate the 1%, Seven Areas to Nurture for Success. And he talks about behavior, connection, innovation, mental health, and emotional health. Interestingly enough, he's got a couple of degrees to go along with that, one from Worcester Polytechnic Institute in biomedical engineering, and from North Carolina State University, one in mechanical engineering. So he's bridging worlds already. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Zen. It's great to be here.
Isn't it? It's great just to be here now, anywhere, right? So, you know, we explore the inner and outer activities and how we first get in touch with them. And going back into your young life and what you can remember, was there a time that you began to understand that there was an interconnection that you had to the world that went beyond what the outer awareness was telling you from others?
Where do I begin, right? You know, so, you know, when you ask about early life, you know, I really want to go back to like childhood, you know, like six, seven, eight. But as you were asking the question, it had me thinking of really around the age 16, right around 16 years old, when I really started thinking about who am I? You know, who do I want to be? Why do I do what I do? Why do people do what they do? And it was around 16 years old that I really started asking that question. So I think that was really kind of the turning point. Like I was raised in I'm the youngest of three kids, but I was raised in a environment that was very, as my friend who's very into the Myers-Briggs, you know, personality assessment and all, which I'm a fan of that.
Me too.
I'm just not into it as much as she is. So kudos to her. But she's like, you were raised in a total SJ environment, which is plan everything out, your five senses, that's how you get all your information, do what you're supposed to do, and you'll do well, you know, in this world, you'll succeed in this world. And my parents are both strong SJs, my brother, strong SJ, you know, he's the oldest, right? So my parents say, oh, we're doing good. Like, look at how successful David is. And my sister comes along and she follows the same pattern, going to the, you know, gifted and talented camps in the summer and getting good grades and everything. Another SJ, a perfect SJ. My parents thinking, man, we got this parenting thing down, you know? And then Kevin comes along and like, what do we do with this one? Like, I am... at my core, I am not an SJ, but I identified as an SJ for the first, 20, 30, more than 30, 40 years of my life. I identified as an SJ, but even at age 16, I was starting to tap into my N, my intuition, and not, I mean, I'm still pretty structured and all, but I can totally just go.
Nothing wrong with structure, is there?
Oh, no, nothing wrong with that. I mean, it's like, you know, SJs are like 70% of the population. Sure. But, you know, I've, and through my adult life, especially my early adult life, really working to balance out all aspects, you know, of like the Myers-Briggs, all four areas. But it was like around 16 that I was really starting to, crack the dam or open the door a little bit.
Change your thinking a little bit and put your attention, intention, and interaction towards inquiry of you.
Yeah.
Instead of trying to fit a mold. And I can understand how, you know, when you're brought up in that structure, that you're going to want to fit in, right?
Right.
Well, you fit in to survive. How many conversations do we have about fitting in, right? Is that really healthy, though? And as you were in your younger days, before 16, when you were younger and you were playing around and out in nature and things like that, were there moments where you just felt this connection and that was unquestionable? Maybe you didn't intellectualize it. However, just being in the environment kind of anchored it.
I'm not sure. I know that I saw things differently and I was not always going with the flow. A really good example, and this is from the very younger years, you know, like 7, 8 years old. We used to take family trips twice a year from Maryland to Florida. That was like our twice a year vacation. And we would drive typically. So this is, you know, the 70s, and you pile the kids in the back of the station wagon and you road trip. You know, it's the classic.
Sure.
Classic. Oh,
been there, done that. My parents did it as well. Yeah.
Right.
Bradenton, and Sarasota, Bradenton area.
I'm sorry?
Bradenton, Sarasota.
Oh, okay. Right. Right.
Sarasota, that's where Florida. We always went.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We were just down like in Hollywood. So just south of Fort Lauderdale. But time and again, you know, we'd stay overnight, you know, halfway down or whatever. And it's like, okay, we had dinner and, oh, we're going to get ice cream. Everyone, we're going to get ice cream. I don't want ice cream. What? You don't want ice cream? No, I don't want ice cream. And I was like made to feel bad for, I was like, no, I don't want it. No, just try it. Just have it. Just like, no, I know what it tastes like. I don't want ice cream. I know people are like freaking out here watching, like, he doesn't want ice cream. Everybody loves ice cream. No, ice cream wasn't my, it's like, if you want me to have something, just give me some quarters and I'll play arcade games.
Yeah. Or how, you know, about asking me what I would want rather than supposing I would.
Wouldn't that be wonderful? With
whether I do or don't.
Yeah, that was not, I can't remember ever being asked, what do you want? Because I would easily say like, oh, I'd rather have a piece of cake or some cookies or brownie. Or donut. I mean, donuts are like my all-time favorite. But, you know, who eats donuts after dinner? Donuts are only for the morning, right? Because you got to follow the structure, you know? Right. You got to put in a box. Yeah. And so that was like a very early introduction to like, no, I don't always do what everybody else does. It's not like I have to be different, but I tend to be different. But I'm also the same of everyone else, too. So... But that was a very early on recurring experience where I really felt like bad because I didn't want ice cream. Mm-hmm. Even today, if I say like, oh, you know, if I'm at a party or something, or, you know, it's like the company birthday party, you know, where everybody gathers and all, like, oh, I'll have a piece of cake. Oh, and ice cream too? Like, no. Like, what? You don't want ice cream? Like, I'm still shamed to this day. You know, for not wanting ice cream. Like, it is, right. It's like blasphemy. And, but
that,
you know,
that gives new meaning to we all scream for ice cream, right?
Yeah, right. I scream to not have ice cream, you know? It's just, but like at my core, like, I know that is not right for me, but it goes against, you know, what most people want.
This brings up a great point, and you know, in your work and emotional health, right? How do you set healthy boundaries there to where you can identify and share with others with some kind of response of acknowledgement, at least, if not acceptance and embracing it? Oh, yeah, this person has just got different.
You see, I'm like a deer in headlights. Like, that does not happen. Like, how does a 7-year-old set boundaries? All I could really do is dig in and resist. That's really all that I could do. Is like, no, I'm not eating it. You know, like I.
And how often does that happen now in our adult world? Right.
Oh,
Same thing.
Oh, absolutely. The same thing happens. And, you know, the idea of acknowledging that Kevin doesn't want ice cream, or validating, you know, which is a much, you know, a much bigger part of the equation. I'd say acknowledgement would be like 10%, which is good. It's something.
Step in the right direction.
it's a step in the right direction, yes. But validation of my feelings would be, but people do not know how to do either, really. Most people, I'm generalizing, I'm a big generalist,
but I totally...
most people don't know how to acknowledge or validate. And when we don't feel either one of those, then we don't feel heard or understood. And that right there makes us feel like we don't matter and that we don't have value. And in our brain, value translates to love. Value is love. Mm-hmm. The more valuable you are, feel, the more loved you feel. And love is a basic human need, just like air and water. And that's my definition for emotional health, is our ability to give and receive love, connection, and belonging.
You hit the core. We talk about mission and purpose and reason for being here and those questions. And like you were talking, you know, at 16, you began to question those. I found that the core element beyond anything is simply to love and be loved.
That's it. That's the definition. That's my definition anyway. And it took a little while to figure that out and land on that.
Because there's so many conditions on that to begin with.
Well, typically, right? But it's,
and then we got to work through all that.
Yeah, it needs to be unconditional, because anytime we put a condition on that love and connection, then it's not really love. It's not real connection. And that is where, to me, that is where humanity is struggling. We do not know how to actually give and receive true love, connection, and belonging. And when a basic need is not being met, it causes pain. Just like the basic need of air. When you don't have air, if someone's cutting off your airway, nothing else in the universe matters except getting air. And you are incredibly uncomfortable or in pain. Because your airway, your basic need is cut off. And I've landed on, you know, just six basic needs. And these are universal to all human beings, actually all primates, actually all mammals. You might even go further, but let's land on mammals.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're going to keep extending that?
I'm going to land on mammals for right now.
All right.
But it does go to reptiles and that kind of thing too.
And all creatures.
So all fauna, maybe not flora so much, but that's remained to be seen, right? I'll leave that open, but definitely all fauna. So the basic needs, like where I've landed, and this is universal, like everyone's different, everyone's an individual, but every human being, every mammal needs air, water, food. Now, granted, you might be vegetarian, I might be lactose intolerant, but we all need food.
Mm-hmm.
We all need sleep. You try and go 24 hours without sleep, you are in a world of hurt, right?
Depends. You know, I've done events for many years, and there are 24, 26, 28-hour days that fly by. But generally speaking,
you
go by, you got to have
train yourself. Yeah, you can train yourself up for some of these. But generally speaking, you go 24 hours without sleep, it's not going to be.
You're in an altered state at that point.
Right? And then safety and shelter. So shelter from like the elements, right? If you're in a hurricane or a blizzard, you, without shelter, that's not going to be a good situation for, you know, in a couple of hours.
Right.
And safety, you know, like back in the day from a saber-toothed tiger, or today bullets whizzing by your, you know, home. I mean, that happens, right? That's a thing. Or, you know, if you happen to be black or brown, just walking out of your house is a tense
risk.
A tense, stressful environment risk, right? Because in the United States anyway, if you're not a white Christian heterosexual male, you are less valuable than anyone else. And again, value translates to love. And when we don't feel love, it causes pain. And now our body has to deal with that pain, that stress, that cortisol that's pumping through our system. You know what that does to your brain chemistry? It changes your brain chemistry. You know what it does to your cardiovascular system and your pancreas? And You know, why do you think Black people have, you know, more issues with cardiovascular health and diabetes and struggled with COVID way more than white people?
Native Americans too.
Right? It's not just because of the access, the physical access and all of the bias within the healthcare system and all those problems, but just being non-white or non-heterosexual, your immune system, your being is already compromised, and dealing with all of that on a day-to-day basis, it's no wonder that those populations struggle with, you know, ailments, disease, so on, more than, say, a white male or something.
Mm-hmm. Now, back to when you were 16 and you began...
Sorry, I went really off there.
No, that's all right. We're all tangential assimilationists, right? We pick up everything and we become what is good for us. Right?
There you go.
In this exploration that you began, where did it take you to early on? You started asking about your form, fit, and function in the world, so to speak, and what that might be. How did you progress with that? What did you find initially that led you to a more expanded, even deeper view of who you are and what you can do?
Well, it took a while. You know, so 16 years old, the expectation was going to college. I'm living in this SJ environment, you know, perform, do. I definitely had an affinity toward math and science and, you know, English and history and sociology. Just, you know, those subjects were like, who needs that? That stuff is useless. That's what I thought back then, you know, which I could not be more wrong. I did have some interest in psychology. So I took some psych courses in college, you know, as my electives, my humanities electives.
Mm-hmm.
But I was still so focused on the engineering path and the, you know, having a definitive answer for everything, you know. But I was also, even in high school, I also felt a pull, a need, a desire to get into the medical side of things. The human body just absolutely fascinated me, you know, even in high school, like just how this machine, the human machine, how that worked. And that just, so I even took, like, I took a health occupations course in high school. It was at a different high school, but I just knew it got bussed over there for like two periods a day kind of a thing. And then we worked in a hospital, and I actually got to work with patients. You know, I would bathe, you know, help bathe patients, take vital signs. Like, we learned how to do all that stuff in the high school class. And then the second semester we worked in hospitals like volunteers. I mean, I helped bathe a quadriplegic, you know, in his bed, and help shave. I didn't even know how to shave at that point, but I shaved a man, you know, and how that felt. And really, to me, it just, looking back now, helping in that service type industry and helping people who are sick or ill or injured gave me a sense of value. Then I felt valuable. I didn't realize this at the time, but that's the feeling that was really going on, is I can help someone else and then I feel valuable. And then that really translated into biomedical engineering. So going straight from mechanical engineering, which I loved all of that. I had no idea. When I was going into mechanical engineering, I'm thinking like, oh, design cars and planes and, you know, robotic arms and legs and that kind of thing. This is like mid late 80s. And I had no idea that mechanical engineering was like thermodynamics, fluid dynamics, heat transfer. I had no idea about any of that stuff.
During that same period, I was a production control coordinator for an aerospace company.
Oh, there you go.
So I had to know what all. I had to deal with manufacturing engineers on a day-to-day basis.
Right?
And I'd learned so much. Fascinating, right?
About I loved what you could
do with metals and structure and
oh my god, dynamics. Material science.
Yeah.
Yeah, I loved it all. Like to actually understand how flight works, how a turbine engine works, like a jet engine versus propeller, you know, like mm-hmm. I was like, this is so cool. I loved it. But you know, trying to get a job out of school was really, really tough. So now it's early 90s. And I was like, well, I'll try grad school, you know, and I'll really focus in on this health stuff that I liked back in high school. I'll focus in and I'll get a degree in biomedical engineering. So then I could really, you know, hone that and take that as my career path, which is what I did, right? But again, I'm still very, you know, engineering, numbers, mm-hmm. that kind of thing.
Inside the box, so to
speak. Oh, totally inside the box. Yeah, like just, you know, and not very good at it either. Like, I mean, my undergrad, like... I had this conversation the other day. It's funny that's coming up again, but like my undergrad GPA, I graduated from NC State with a 2.6 GPA. So if you graduate college with less than a 3.0, you're basically thought of as like an idiot. I mean, that's how I felt anyway. Like you didn't get a 3.0 and like, you're stupid. You're
dumb. CSF coming through.
Yeah. Like you're an idiot, you know? And my advisor's like, don't even bother applying to grad school. You'll never get in if you don't have a 3.0. Like, just forget it, you know? And I'm like, well, I'm going to apply anyway. So they're bucking the system a little bit, right?
You rebel rouser.
I know, right? And, but I, you know, to NC State's credit or not, they don't curve ever. Like, when I was in school, there was never a curve on grades. Like, I took a test one time. It was for control systems class, which I love this class. I was so into it. And on one test that I studied really hard for, and I really knew the material, I thought, I got a 24 on that test out of 100. Yeah, I got 24%. The average was like a 34, but I got a 24%. And that was the failing grade, you know? And I actually failed a course, not that one, but I failed a course earlier in my undergrad career, a core mechanical engineering course. I straight up failed it. Even if I would have gotten 100% on the final, I would have gotten below 60% as my overall grade. So I didn't even go to the final because there's no way I was going to get 100%. And even then it wouldn't matter. So then I retook the course in summer school, which actually turned out to be like a really good thing for me going to summer school at NC State. Mm-hmm. But, and I got the highest overall grade in the class. Like I was the top of the class.
So what and was I the got, difference?
Well, the difference from the regular semester to the summer school was I didn't just go through the homework and copy it from a friend and review it and be like, oh yeah, I get it. I actually worked through everything and made sure I could actually do it on my own.
Oh, what a novel idea.
Well, who would have thought, right? I thought I was getting it. Like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Oh, I got it. Go to the test, fail, yeah. You know, yeah. Regular semester. But in the summer school, you know, I really dialed it in.
You know, the interesting thing about education, when you're in passive learning, you gain about 40% of the information, if that. Right, that's the math, right? Right? And I learned this in my teacher ed degree. I taught high school for almost a decade. And if you teach the material to another, you retain 98% of it.
Oh, yeah. That makes total sense to me.
Yeah. So why do we have students teaching other students instead of, you know, the sage on stage environment, classroom? In some schools, that actually takes place now.
Right, which is wonderful, but no, we have to stick with this authoritarian style in the hierarchy that I'm the teacher, you're the student, do what I say and just get it perfectly, mm-hmm. You know. So, but back to the story about the grades. So I ended up with an 89.4% in the actually, was it 4 or 6? I think it was an 89.6% was my final overall grade in the class.
Mm-hmm.
89.6, and I got a B. And I was the highest grade in the class. and I still got a B. He didn't curve it up to an A. So they don't curve at NC State, or they didn't back when I was there. And
numbers are numbers. Boundaries are set. Yeah, we need to learn that that's the way it is. And yeah, this, you know, there's this sense of, well, we want to, you know,
even it out, don't make people feel too bad, and so on.
Okay, well, the material is the material. You learn it, you don't, and you accept the facts.
Well, and that's how NC State works. And actually, I love them for that. Now, looking back, I did not like that. But now, but I'll tell you what,
right?
The kids. But then, when I was in corporate America, and the kids coming out of school, coming out of Maryland, Clemson, Virginia Tech, you know, all the engineering schools, like up and down the East Coast, they come into the workplace with way higher GPAs than what I ever could come close to. They couldn't do anything in the workplace. Like, you give them a blank sheet of paper, they are a deer in headlights. They are stuck. Now, I'm generalizing, remember, mm-hmm. but for the most part, they are. But if you give them a problem to solve, and you got to remember, this problem has to be frictionless with no heat loss, and right, it has to be a perfect environment, right? Mm-hmm. Or else they can't solve it, you know? And the funny thing about that is, I graduate mechanical engineering with a 2.6, and my GPA in grad school was a lot higher. But I also had a lot fewer classes, and I had learned how to, like, actually go through and learn the material, which was really a lot of fun, actually. Mm-hmm. Like, to actually know how to use calculus, like, as a tool. Wow. Like, I didn't know that in undergrad, but in grad school, I finally got that, and I'm like, calculus is awesome. Like, it's so efficient, you know? So the great things, where was I going with that? But then when it comes to problem solving and creative problem solving, I'm the one with 80 patents, and most of the engineers at the office are lucky to, most of them don't have any, because they can't come up with these creative ideas. They can only do what's on the paper and the problem right in front of them in a perfect environment. Again, I'm generalizing, but you give them a blank sheet of paper and a problem and say, come up with a solution, they're lost. And now when you extrapolate that to the challenges that high schools and colleges and the workplace has, like, we need creative problem solving, we need innovation. Well, that's one reason why I wrote the book. And the book has nothing to do with grades or courses or test scores or anything like that. Nothing at all. Because that's not where the real creative problem solving comes from, in my opinion.
Where do you think it comes from?
Well, there's seven areas that I have identified that, you know, I have nurtured through through my life. But even in the book, I talk about this. Where most of my creative problems, my belief that I can solve anything, really, is because I was my father's apprentice for 18 years. I learned from him on all manner of topics. We fixed the dishwasher, we're replacing the garbage disposal, we fixed the lawnmower, we add an addition onto the house. We restore a 1968 Mustang convertible. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're doing not to mention all the things out of nothing that my dad wanted to create for the house. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I'd really like to have a side table over here for the couch, and I want it to look like this, and you know, I saw these three pedestal tables in a store, and I'm like, I can make that myself. This is my dad talking, right? I can make that myself. So he, you know, took pen, paper and pencil, and he measured everything at the store.
Yeah.
And then he came home and built it with, like, frosted glass top with a light bulb inside to light it up from inside. It was beautiful, beautiful, you know. Oh, and
cool. And to have that kind of structure, opportunity to experience, you know, my dad was kind of the same style, right? He was a tool and die maker in the auto industry. He
built
plastic injection molds for X cars, mm-hmm. millions of an inch tolerances. And he used to say, you know, anybody could give you a shot, but I can make the needle.
Right. I love that. That is beautiful. Yeah. Yeah. So that's really where, my creative, I didn't really learn creative problem solving from any of the engineering that I learned how to solve those problems.
Sure.
But to solve real
well, most problems, of those were empirical.
Right. You need real world problems, you know, and just one example, I think this is from the first chapter of the book, actually. But one example was I happened to be attending a spinal operation, a spinal implant operation, you know, and I'm standing on the back wall just observing and everything. Mm-hmm. And I won't go into the big long story of it, but basically the spinal surgeon needed to cut a metal rod to length. And he took the rod cutter out of the tool set, you know, out of the instrument set, and it jammed, it failed. It didn't work. So he's like, crap, you know, this is like the easiest part of surgery, by the way. Cutting the rod is like easy, you know, it's supposed to be. And then he's like, go get me another one. So the sales rep, you know, had to go get another one. And so had to open up a whole nother set, break it sterile. So now it has to go back through central processing. This has cost a lot of time and money, not to mention the patient is still under anesthesia and you don't want a patient under anesthesia any longer than they need to be, right?
Right.
So he gets the next one, it jams, it breaks. He's like, just get me the bolt cutters. Now the bolt cutters are like, you know, 2.5 feet long. It's what you find in an auto shop, literally. It's just all stainless steel and, you know, it's been sterilized.
Yeah.
But that's all it is. It's the same. It's this giant metal steel bolt cutter. And he cut the rod with that and it leaves a horrible sharp edge, but that's what it does. And this added like 20 minutes to surgery. Not to mention the amount of frustration and anger that the surgeon had. And then when the surgeon's upset, that energy that just bleeds out to everybody,
mm-hmm.
you know, nobody wants to be in that room, you know? And I'm like, this is the easiest part of surgery. So I identified a problem, a real problem that had real consequences in a lot of different ways, not to mention to the patient, you know? And so I go back to my designer, long story short, we come up with, well, my designer did, but the next day he came up with a beautiful, elegant solution overnight. He did this. He literally came up with this overnight. And the next day he comes back in. He's like, Kevin, check this out. And he had this little bitty pipe cutter that's like, you know, $7 at Home Depot. And he takes a rod.
Twist it in, spin it around, and voila.
And then he just took some Insight 2 rod benders, which are in any instrument set for spinal instruments, and he just goes and he snaps it with a perfect edge that has no sharps. That is how you solve problems. You identify a real problem and then just pull whatever else is already, because most of the stuff's been figured out somewhere somehow, mm-hmm. and just apply it to your need. That's how you can really solve problems.
Absolutely. And it's so, like you said, elegant.
Oh my God.
When it all falls together, there's flow, because first of all, you have the curiosity. Second of all, you have the knowledge. And third, you have the drive to do it.
Yeah, drive and motivation, right. Yeah. And then, you know, then we ended up turning into, I was like, well, we could do this. I ended up turning it into a reusable instrument that had replacement cartridges. So then it became a new revenue stream for our company. So that, imagine like that, it's right? Like a win-win-win-win-win, you know. Right. So,
but we've got a mutual friend on the bench, Dr. Eric Zabigalski, who wrote The Ambidextrous Organization, and he talks about how they're twofold, right? There's the exploitive and the explorative. Mm-hmm. And most companies, corporations get caught up in the exploitive because they're trying to get the market share. And they don't explore what's coming in the future and prepare for when that product curve reaches its end, and all product curves do.
Yeah, like Kodak or something.
Right. So those kinds of things are just really, to me, I find fascinating, especially in the real world where there's this inner creativity that is unleashed when the problem occurs. And then there's the trust in your own ability to perform it. It's like, yeah, I don't have the answers. I know I'll figure it out.
Well, so that right there is what I learned. I'd gotten some stuff through college and whatnot, but it was really in my job at Amron, which is back, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, where I was doing a lot of software, writing a lot of software and developing little sensors for like behavior modification, medical devices. And
Wait a minute. Are you setting up a new system for electrical shocks?
Oh God, no, nothing even close to that. I mean, it was so, it was so analog compared to that, you know?
Yeah. I didn't think so.
Yeah, I know you're kidding.
It seemed a good moment to interject.
Yeah.
And yet there were times back when we were talking in the 70s and 80s where electrical shocks were commonplace.
That was standard treatment.
Mental treatment, right?
Absolutely. Standard treatment.
My cousin had 51 of them because he had a bad acid trip.
Right. Yeah. Oh my God. Terrible.
And it left him a vegetable.
Yeah. They killed him.
I was just livid. Yeah. You know, here was this guy that I knew that was brilliant. We had a lot of fun with. We could talk about anything. Really smart, sharp.
Heartbreaking.
And then he goes through this. And same kind of system, the very same system that labeled me, as we talked earlier, and it destroyed him. I was just heartbroken over that.
I mean, we like to think people are doing the best that they can, but they're hurting, you know, and
yeah, how and is it
destroying how is lives into a vegetable families?
Good for them?
It's not good for that person. But it's good for the system, you know, it perpetuates the system, like, but we're trying to, you know, it's, oh my God.
Stop trying, will you?
In that case.
Friends like you, we don't need enemies.
Yeah, for sure.
And it's funny how, you know, we talk about this and in their minds, it's all done with good intentions, right? They think. Because of their training, because of their book learning, because of the
program, of their status,
right, that they're an authority, they're an expert.
Because they got that piece of paper.
Right.
They got that position. They have that status. Yeah. And then that's all exploited again, you know.
And in a sense, you know, in some cases we can see them as kind of educated idiots because they don't include the other aspects of the humanness and the creativity.
No, they're only focused on where is the singular issue? Oh, your pain is there. I'm going to address that right there. And they're not looking at the bigger picture. They're too narrowly focused.
Like, why do you have that pain to begin with?
Exactly.
Is there, you know, it's like software, the cascading problems that occur in operating systems for, you know, when you got a line of code that's out of whack.
Yeah. And then it transfers all the way down the line to something else. Like, why is that problem having? And, you know, and it's so funny. So that really relates back to that story at Amron where I would get stuck. Like, I'm like, I cannot figure this out. I go to my boss. I'm like, Steve, I've been working on this for 2.5 days. I don't know. I am, and there was no one else there because I was the only one. It was me and my boss. There was no other people there, you know? Mm-hmm. So I'm stuck. And he would say to me, he's like, well, you'll figure it out. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, seriously? But it was that total confidence and belief in me. And you know what happened every single time? I figured it out every single time. I figured out some kind of solution that now, worked.
Is this a mind, I don't want to say mindset because I think that's a wrong term. I think a mind flow is a better word where you're activating that creative, innovative part of you. That you don't know what you can't do, so you don't put the limits on yourself.
Well, that's a big thing, right? Is all the limits that other people put on ourselves and then we also put on ourselves. That's a whole chapter. That's like the fifth chapter in my book is all about breaking the glass ceiling and removing all of these self-imposed or other people imposed limits. And that stifles so much innovation and creative problem solving and just what you can do in your life,
right?
You know, anything in your life. But I also think it's, and I can't remember the quote from the movie and I can't remember which movie it was, but it was something like, you know, sometimes you need someone else to believe in you first before you can believe in yourself.
Mm.
And again, this goes back to love, connection, and belonging. When my boss, like, unconditionally believed in me, he said it, he would, and he did this more than once, but it's so matter-of-factly, like, well, you'll figure it out. And I'm like, oh, but I did every time, you know? And I'm going to now transfer this right over straight up to love. And again, this misbelief that humans have that we're still operating from, which we are under the belief that you have to love yourself before you can love anyone else. We all know it. Everybody's accepted it. That's the way it is. You can't love anyone else unless you love yourself first. But that is fundamentally incorrect, because when we evolve as a human, when we're born, we do not know how to self-love. When you're 2, 3, 4 years old, you know nothing about self-love. You know, you have no self-awareness at that age. You don't even become a little bit self-aware until like age 6 or 7. That's when you start to become aware. So maybe you can start to love yourself. But you know nothing about self-love for the first like 6 years of your life. So how, if you don't know how to self-love, what's going on in your early years? But what you do know is the love of your parent. And if you don't feel and you don't learn what that healthy, unconditional love is in those early years, if you don't learn what love is first, then you're going to struggle to give love to others and to yourself when you get older. So that's how I see the self-love thing. I'll put one correlation on that, which is, I think as an adult, you can work on self-love and giving and receiving love with others at the same time. You can nurture both. But the way humans evolve is you must first learn how to love before you can love others. That's how I see it anyway.
I can see that, and I still wonder, reason being, I was orphaned at birth and adopted at 6 weeks. Parents told me at 4 and a half when my sister came home, who was also adopted. And then I began questioning things and wondering who my parents, real parents were, why. Right, all of those kinds of things. But I had an interesting question that I haven't heard anybody else speak about, adoptees especially. And that's because of the environment, because I grew up in, dad was a 32nd degree Mason, mom sang in the choir, and both of them actually sang in the choir at the church, United Methodist. And so I got some early exposure to that. My question was, do I have a father and mother in heaven, and can I talk to them?
Wow.
It turns out I could. There was a voice that came a few months later that validated that, and I began to establish this communication. Unique, weird as it may be, it was valid and still is today. Now, in that process, I also had this natural loving nature toward others. I was always giving and sharing and doing stuff. I'd see somebody struggling, I'd help them out. These were just things I didn't think twice about. I just did. Now, and I'm realizing, you know, as I grew up, that they're part of that, what you're talking about, the unconditional love that you get from your parents. I got that from my adoptive parents. And so that also helped bolster that willingness to be vulnerable enough to risk the help and rejection as a result, if it ever occurred. And sometimes it does, right? Because people always want help. Oh, I can do it myself.
Sure.
Right, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And yet, you learned it, you know, from your adoptive parents were teaching you this kind of how to love.
And as
they were exemplifying it, they were modeling it for
absolutely
you.
And yet there were some aspects of that when I got older, I learned that, okay, dad used to say, you know, damn it, you got to trust everybody. That's a form of love. right? Mm-hmm. And then I realized, oh, okay, there's a thing about boundaries and discernment.
Discern. Mm-hmm.
And those, you know, things that, because I was in a diminished place in myself, I didn't have enough love for me, I wasn't able to offer that to another.
Right.
So that there's a catch 22 in what you're saying is you still mm-hmm. have to love yourself in order to be able to fully love another. Otherwise, you can't do it. The equation isn't balanced.
Yeah. And to that point, you know, it's the spectrum, right? Mm-hmm. And or it's the pendulum that's going back and forth.
I've often wondered if I was on the spectrum.
Yeah, well, maybe so. maybe we all are, really.
Yeah, I think so.
Probably. And I don't think anyone is raised with absolute zero love. And I don't think anyone is raised with 100% perfect love. And I think it goes back and forth. My mm-hmm. parents did amazing, wonderful things for us kids. And they were amazing, wonderful parents in so, so many ways. And they also completely screwed us up in so, so many ways, you know. And that's my journey, you know, is dealing, because they were great and they messed me up, you know, mm-hmm. not because they wanted to, but they didn't know any better, you know. They did right. the best that they
did
could,
the best they could with no manuals.
With no manuals, which I'm sort of trying to help create, but right. you know, Dr. Spock, you know, we can update all that kind of stuff. Right. But they, you know, they try their best, they do their best, but you can't do what you don't know, you know. And I think too often what we're doing is what we do know, and what we do know is very destructive, you know, like, oh, love in my house means dad hits mom if she doesn't make a good dinner. Isn't that what love is in your house? You know, love in my house is, you know, mom sleeps with the neighbor when dad's at work. Isn't that love in your house? You know, like, I mean, so we don't, you know, all these destructive behaviors are happening and we're getting all these mixed signals, and some stuff's really great and some stuff is really not. And we know a lot of stuff is really not great because that's what causes us pain, emotional pain.
Mm-hmm.
And then we turn to behaviors to try and ease our pain because we don't know how to really love and connect and belong. And that's emotional health.
So how did you find that process for yourself? And what was the inner connection that you found, if there was one, that was the key to opening up the rest of the story, to quote Paul Harvey?
Yeah. So, you know, it's a journey, you know. I had an epiphany in 2001, in December of 2001. I happened to be watching a TV show and observing an argument between a father and his teenage daughter. And it occurred to me, it occurred to me that they weren't sharing how they really felt or what they really thought. They weren't being completely open and honest with each other. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, God, I am so open and honest with people. I just tell them if they don't like it, you know, tough. But I'm just open and honest about stuff. And I don't really have arguments like this, you know, like I, so it occurred, that was my epiphany, is if I can help people share what they're really thinking and how they're really feeling so they can be heard and understood, then I can help eliminate so much argument and conflict and pain in the world. Mm-hmm. That was the epiphany.
Okay. That is a phenomenal one. And it also is echoed throughout many books and movies and things. And, you know, specifically, I'm thinking of The Fifth Habit of Stephen Covey's, right?
No, I don't know that.
Seek first to understand.
Right. Wouldn't that be nice?
Right? Then to be understood.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And what you're talking about is the empathic.
Oh, totally. So this is, I'm like 31 years old or something. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it took from 16 to 31, I mean, it was through my late 20s that I was really starting to get into, you know, me and the emotional side, and it's not all just numbers and everything. It was right when I got into the workplace that I realized how critically important English and being able to read and like write is, because I always discounted English, but I had to start writing memos to, you know, people in the company, and you need to be really clear, you know, and oh my God, I wish I paid more attention back in English class and writing and everything, because I was like, no, no, number science, that's all that matters.
I'm laughing. Oh. My mother was an English teacher.
Yeah, I mean, like, I wish I would have, you know, put more effort back then.
I got such a setup, and what a blessing to be adopted by the, you know, the folks.
Yeah, right. And we use what we're given or what's presented to us and do the best that we can, you know. Mm-hmm. But it was, so I was like 31 when that epiphany came, but it took me 15 years to figure out that this solution that I created, which is the Uchi app, you know, to bring people closer together. What I thought I was solving straight up was, oh, I can help reduce conflict and help families, you know, connect and love, and behaviors are going to improve. And all that's true. But it took me 15 years to figure out what I was really solving was my need to feel heard and understood by my parents. Because I never go back to the 7-year-old who Kevin doesn't like ice cream, right? They don't understand me, and they don't even know how to acknowledge it, much less validate that. So Uchi is really my solution to my problem to feel heard and understood by my parents. And let me tell you, it works awesome. But that's really
amazing what can happen with good use of technology.
It's just another tool, you know, and when you use a tool well, it's great, right? But if you use a tool poorly, it can be catastrophic. For example, a hammer is a great tool for banging in nails and building a house. That's a wonderful tool. Mm-hmm. But you can use a hammer to bash someone in the head and kill them. That's a terrible use for that tool. So I think a lot of ways we use the internet and smartphones not in a good way, and it's well proven through like social, you know, the research on social media, how poor of a tool or how poor of a use of this tool, the internet and smartphones, is being used. Uchi is my attempt at using this tool in a really constructive way, mm-hmm. that can help a lot of people. And what I learned is that I'm not the only one who doesn't feel heard and understood by their parents.
Oh, I think we all do at some point, right? That's the nature of growing up.
Right.
And the shifting, because each generation has a different
perspective,
new level of mm-hmm. experience and perception, mm-hmm. because the world has changed.
It's different. It is different. Yeah. Yeah.
And we often look back and say, well, it was this way when I was a kid, it ought to be this way for you now. Well, we don't like the way kids learn today. Right? We don't consider a holistic educational system. We don't address the spiritual side. We don't address the emotional side.
We don't address the most important part of learning, which is the relationship between the teacher and the student.
Right.
That's an afterthought. But well, that was my first 18 years of life with my parents, with my dad especially, but right. My mom too, and the other side of things.
And children cannot learn if they're not emotionally available.
No, if their amygdala is hijacked, which is a, you know, psychological term,
right?
When your amygdala is hijacked, your frontal lobe does not engage. And that's when, that's your thinking and reasoning and deciding. That's what you need for school. But most kids are coming to school or emotionally hijacked, or they get to school and they get triggered and now they're emotionally hijacked. And it's not like the gazelle out on the plane that, you know, 15 seconds later, they calm down because there's no longer a threat from the leopard. We are in a constant state of this high beta, always on alert, and more often it's not the physical threat in today's society. It's not the constant physical threat, it's the constant emotional. And none of this has anything to do with the mental, which is the frontal lobe stuff. It's right. All the amygdala emotion, which I go to the heart, but it's the amygdala. it's all the emotional side of things. And we just completely discount that.
So let's look at that for a moment. Emotion, energy in motion, right? Where does, there's some energy in motion here, but most of it's in our body, right?
Oh, yeah, right.
The body keeps the shoulders up. Mm-hmm. And we're unaware of how the body is. And so with that prescriptive notion you're talking about, we shove everything down into our body and create dis-ease in it. And it manifests all kinds of different ways, unaware that we're the cause of it. We give it external causes to, and some of those may be correct with the environment and chemicals and things of that nature. However,
sure, if but we more didn't often have
that, they couldn't lodge in our body in order and create the disease if we didn't open the door to it to begin with.
Now, absolutely. And we're creating, our parents are creating these environments, our parents, our schools, our workplaces. These are the main places that I've identified anyway that, I mean, this is where you spend most of your time, right? The first 6 years of your life, you're with your parents and family, you know, in this household. And then for the next 12 years, you're at school, you know, maybe a little bit more. And then for the next, you know, 30 years, you're working for this employer, and we're still operating under this this hierarchy, this do what I say, the whole pointing thing that we talked about earlier, you know, and it causes all this emotional trauma. And the emotional trauma is not just the big T trauma. That's what the whole mental health field needs to understand, and society needs to understand. When we say trauma, we're usually thinking about big T trauma, you know, the sexual abuse and the physical
overt
abuse
traumas,
the really big overt traumas. But what we're completely overlooking are the little T traumas, which I have landed on four. There's others, but the four most common ones that I've seen are shame, judgment, degradation, and emotional neglect. And we are raising children in these environments, let's just say shame and judgment, so I don't have to go through all four. Mm-hmm. But when you are constantly being shamed or judged, I grew up in an incredibly judgmental and critical, constant criticism environment. That was my environment also. I got all this great love, you know, and bonding, but I also got constant criticism. No matter what I did, it wasn't good enough.
Right.
And it wasn't like
I got that's good. We know you can do better.
Right. Right. Or if you would have done what we said, you would have gotten an A. You know, that's my parents speaking. I got that the time.
More like that than not. I think there was some wisdom with my parents where they didn't go that far, but they knew the edge that they could hedge.
Okay. But think about the emotional trauma my parents have from their early childhood. So now they don't feel valued. So now they're trying to feel
patterns.
Whether it's
cultural memes, you know, it's bloodlines, it's cultural, it's regional, right? All of these things.
It's very environmental. It's nurture, mm-hmm. not nature. Right. You know, you don't pass down judgment in your genes. You know, that's not like there's no chromosome or gene that's got like the judgment gene. There's no gene for evilness or crazy. You know, there's no gene for mean and angry, you know. So this whole genetic argument is it's already been disproven. You know, genes are like 10% of the equation. The environment is such a bigger part. And I got this environment of constant judgment and emotional neglect. You know, if I was crying about something, my parents were like, well, why are you crying about that? It's not a big deal. You know, I don't want to hear you cry. If you want to cry, just go in your room and cry. So I would just go in my room and cry by myself. That's I'm a feeling. I'm empathic.
Sure.
I'm sensitive, you know, and sensitive, that's a negative thing, right? But I was made to feel less than. I was made to feel I'm not good enough. I don't have value, which means I'm not loved. Now, my parents said they love me all the time, but that's like an intellectual love. What they're showing me is that I'm not good enough through all this judgment and all this emotional neglect. That's my pain and trauma. Not to mention they couldn't understand, you know, how I think about the world and everything. So that's the little T trauma that we're missing. And that causes emotional pain. So back to what you're saying, and then that emotion stored in the body. And so go back to what you were saying.
moving from the head down, pushing the energy. We don't, you know, our bodies are instruments. We don't know how to tune, let alone play in concert with, because we don't know enough about them. You know, for me, as a teenager or as a junior high student, my parents got me the Invisible Man model, right? Mm-hmm. So I went through, I knew all the blood vessels, veins, and arteries, bones, muscles. I just had this curiosity to know it all. So I learned it all.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it served me to some degree, but it was just more the curiosity and the building of the knowledge, right?
Mm-hmm.
To know, you know, somebody say something like, oh yeah, that's the, you know, and now I don't know if that was trying to exhibit intellectual prowess. And I think
it's a value, right? If I can share this knowledge, I have value.
Right.
And value translates to love.
Right. Hey, you know, guess what else I know, right? Hey, did you think about this or do this?
Exactly.
And so in that, when we offer new information, something we've discovered, an experience that we've had, the value that we've received, it depends on how we present that as to how it's received.
For sure.
Right. And like you're talking about in understanding the other person and kind of presenting to them in a way that they can hear or feel or see, instead of the way you want to present it from your perspective, because how you do things is different than somebody else. Well, in order to share this information in some way, shape, or form with another, back to Covey's fifth habit, you got to understand them so you can speak right. their language or their math or their science or their profession, their jargon.
We need to listen to it and not discount it.
Right. Use it.
Mm-hmm.
Learn it. Mm-hmm. It may have some value for you too, because it gives you many more, you know, arrows in your own quiver to present.
Absolutely. But so often we shut kids down at such an early age. And by early, I'm talking like before 2 years old. We start shutting them down. Don't emote. Stop crying. Right? I'll do anything to make you stop crying. Or if you keep crying, I'm going to sit you in the corner and you're going to have a timeout. So let's add more trauma, you know? And we're not understanding that person. Yeah.
Right. And it's the understanding. It's the desire. And I think it's because of the situation we've had in the world, we realize that, you know, killing people because they kill people isn't right. It just doesn't feel right. Killing people doesn't feel right. Period.
It does not.
Even though we may feel justified in doing so. Right. And by law, we can in certain situations because they've done certain things and blah, blah, blah. Well, why do
we've decided as a people, you know, that it's acceptable to kill this person in this instance.
Right. How do we do that? How can we let ourselves acquiesce to something that at a core level just feels disconnected?
Because we're here up, we're just thinking, you know, and we're acting out of our
anything.
Brain. Well, our brain, that's what our frontal lobe does. We justify and rationalize all kinds of destructive behaviors or all kinds of extremely constructive behaviors, like professional sports, Olympics, the Tour de France starts on Saturday.
Mm.
You know, these are extreme levels. You know, we revere the Elon Musks and Steve Jobs for what they've brought to the world. Like, we revere that intellect, but look at their personal lives. Their personal lives and relationships are a mess, an utter mess, because that's not what we're valuing. What we're valuing is, what can you do for me? You know, right. What have you created? That's what I value. I don't value your empathy. I don't value your ability to love and be vulnerable and trust. And when we shut that down at such an early age, it doesn't take many times of repeated trauma, of repeated shame or judgment, you know, made to feel bad before you're like, well, I'm not even going to go there anymore. So I'm just going to keep suppressing.
Speaking of not going there anymore, how do we flip that coin?
How do we flip that coin? Well, we need to listen. We need to understand. We need to hear each other. And
we do that. Let's drill down into that for a little bit, because you guys.
Well, that's what Uchi is. Really, I mean, that's literally what Uchi. That's why I created Uchi, because Uchi is it's a social platform that's based on a Q&A approach. So it's not like one of those platforms where you just ask questions and anybody can answer questions. That's not Uchi. Uchi has a database of questions. It's all free. Uchi is a database of questions, and Uchi users answer questions. You answer whatever question, whatever order. They come in groups of 10, but you don't have to go in order or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And the two main rules of Uchi are only your Uchi friends can read your answers. Uchi in Japanese means in-group or inner circle. So only your Uchi, your inner circle, your 5, 10, 20 friends on the Uchi app, only they can read your answer. And they can only read your answer if they've already answered that question. So you have to contribute in order
to consider. That's peeling back the layers in synchrony.
Yeah, it's an asynchronous activity, but you're in synchrony with each other because both parties are participating, which is the opposite of the parent-child relationship. I'm generalizing, right? Mm-hmm. And making fun, but it's the opposite of education, and it's the opposite of the workplace. Mm-hmm. Right? The education is teacher to student, that's it. And boss to employee, that's it. And that's why why do we think kids already hate school in first grade? It's a total judgment fest.
I just want to have fun, and I can't have fun.
Well, and I can't even say my side of it because the teacher's the only one allowed to talk.
Right. I had a
right?
second grade teacher. She was out, and so the principal filled in. And the principal, she was this really stern, you know,
power figure,
control the class, and I'm sitting in the front. And she says something, and I roll my eyes. And she looks at me with, you know, the stern look, right? And she says something else, and I roll my eyes again. And she goes, Mr. Benefield, you roll your eyes again, I'm going to show you the paddle. And I'm like, cool. I want to see it.
Yeah, spite.
Right? Not knowing that's not what she meant. So the next time I rolled my eyes, I went to the office, and not only did I see it, I felt it.
Yeah.
I didn't anticipate that because that's not what she said.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this kind of confusion takes place too.
Oh my God. All the time.
Kids
right?
who listen, they usually take things literally. They don't put any, you know, innuendos to it or read.
They don't have the experience yet. They
don't have the skill set to do so. Yeah. Right? Or to the discernment. And so
certainly not
in the class with this open, you know, admiration and willingness and awe of this figure in the front of the room because they're there to teach us. And so we give our power to them. And then
if we had
listen to them and even as adults now, we don't pay attention to the words that we use.
Oh, very much not.
And so there's these moments that, you know, the reflection moments, the innuendos, the loose comments that they're innocuous or so.
And all the nonverbals as well.
Right. Mm-hmm. Nonverbals. 85% of our conversations are nonverbal.
Yeah. Yeah. But I'll tell you what. So I'm going to purposely bring us back to Uchi.
Mm-hmm.
So Uchi uses only the written word. There's no pictures, there's no video, there's no audio, there's no like button or anything like that. It's only your words. And again, we're under this myth that the only way people can connect, and this was completely reinforced incorrectly or to our detriment through COVID, the only way people can connect is through face-to-face. You got to be in person. It's got to be face-to-face. I got to see your face. It's the only way to connect. It's got to be verbal. That's the only way we're going to have a bond. And we know from 2,500 years of data that that is completely not true, because we know that two people can have a profoundly deep connection just from writing letters.
Mm-hmm.
And Uchi uses the power of the written word. The written word is so powerful, especially when, you know, you use it and practice it, right? And you choose your words well.
I've even heard that words cast spells. That's what spelling is.
Oh, there you go. There you go. I love that. I love that. That's so true, right? So, you know, we completely, like, we've gotten so lazy with pictures and video. And now there's a lot of great benefit, and they can really tell a wonderful story as well,
mm-hmm.
right? But the book is always better than the movie.
It is. It is.
Right?
Now, we're kind of closing on time, and
yeah,
I want to ask one more question. If you could give a piece of advice to the audience that would make a difference in their daily lives, what might that be?
It's really my mission, which is, and Uchi's mission, which is just to connect with the people closest to you. And I don't mean digitally connect and just texting and socializing. I mean to really listen in order to hear and understand that person in a way that they feel heard and understood. You know, really acknowledge and validate their feelings. Doesn't mean you have to agree with what they're going through or what they're saying, but you can acknowledge and validate. And when we do that, when we listen to hear and understand and listen without shaming and judging and degrading or neglecting, that's when we really become closer and connected, and connection makes us happy.
Makes the world go around and evolve as a planetary civilization over time.
Absolutely. Happy people do good things.
Happy people get more done with less supervision and will far exceed your expectations with the right tools and training.
100%.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Kevin, thanks so much for your conversation, for our conversation today, and your willingness to participate. And you shed some great light and insight and understanding, as well as information about moving up in the world and in yourself too.
Yeah.
So thank you very much. I truly appreciate that.
And thank you, Zen. It was a blast.
Awesome. And namaste. And in La Ketch, thanks for sticking with us for this episode of One World in the New World. Again, I'm Zen Benefiel, your host, and I will see you next time.